This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, March 20th, 2018. It's the first day of spring. It's the equinox. It's also 6 months since Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. We'll start there this hour, and we'll end the hour with comedian Aparna Nancharla.
I'm retweeting, so it's going to be okay.
Stick around. It's funny.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us. 6 months ago today, on September 20th, Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Things are slowly getting better in Puerto Rico, but with businesses and infrastructure devastated, 135,000 Puerto Ricans have left the island, according to CBS News, many of them with no firm plans to return. And a lot of them have arrived on the mainland with no real place to go. Well, back in October, FEMA started offering temporary shelter benefits for people displaced by the storm. That shelter for thousands of evacuees took the form of a hotel room somewhere in the United States. But 6 months later, 3,500 Puerto Ricans are still living in hotels and motels under what's called the Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program. Today was supposed to be the deadline cutting off those hotel vouchers, but on Monday, FEMA extended the program until mid-May. Willides Bermudez knows firsthand the toll this process has taken on both families and the cities that have welcomed them on the mainland. Bermudez is a member of the city council in Hartford, Connecticut, and she joins me now. Willides, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Marcela Garcia is also here, an editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Marcela, thanks for being here as well.
Hi, Todd.
Councilwoman Bermudez, let me start with you. How many families remain in hotels in Hartford now, and how did Hartford get involved in accepting them?
Yeah, so in Hartford, we have 20 families right now that remain in hotels. The way that we got involved in getting the families here in the first place, there's two routes. Connecticut is one of the places with one of the largest in the New England area, the largest Puerto Rican population. And by virtue of having family here, friends, loved ones in Hartford, in places like Hartford and other cities, the families started arriving shortly after Hurricane Maria. But also the second route of how families from Puerto Rico ended up here, in particular in the hotels, is that FEMA paid for their plane tickets and for the hotel stays, participating hotels called those families who receive the TSA vouchers. And that's how Hartford got these families.
Well, let's give a listen now, because the Hartford Current has been doing some reporting there in their hometown and went down to a Red Roof Inn in Hartford that has several families from Puerto Rico. Here's Brian Rivera, who moved into that Red Roof Inn in Hartford back in December with his family of four.
I got here 2 days ago. It's been really, really hard. We are staying in only one room, one bed, all four of us. The only thing that I just want to do is for my kids have something where they can stay and have a nice place for them. That's all.
Councilwoman Bermudez, you can hear the resignation in Brian's voice there. You can hear his young baby in the background as well. What are conditions like? What have you seen when you visited the Red Roof Inn and other hotels around town?
It's really challenging for the families who are staying in the hotels. These are families who, again, the plane tickets were purchased by FEMA in many cases. They have been staying in these hotels. At any moment, their hotel stay could be removed from them. And so at any moment, they will be displaced again. And so for them, it's been so challenging not knowing if they are going to be able to get that additional extension. And this is really day to day. So day to day, they wake up in the morning. You know, there's one family in particular who they were bringing their kids to school because, you know, a lot of these families have children. And they came back to the hotel and they said, oh, sorry, you now have to leave. And they're saying, what do you mean I have to leave? I just got back from bringing my kids to school. And so they said, oh, no, there's problems. FEMA said that you can't stay here anymore. Long story short, we got in contact with Senator Blumenthal's office. And after many phone calls and in several hours, they found out that it was a clerical error. That's one case in particular, but there's other families who've been in this state of agony, not knowing what's going to happen next. Now, mind you, they're living in hotels with small children. Some of these children, and Brian's story in particular, he has a one-year-old. He has two little babies, and there's no room. There is no access to a kitchen. There is no area for the children to play. They're in a hotel. The lobby area does not suffice as a playground.
Marcela Garcia of the Boston Globe, you've also spoken with families in your state of Massachusetts, which has a large number of Puerto Rican evacuees as well. How do conditions compare in Massachusetts, similar to what the councilwoman is describing in Hartford?
Absolutely. It's pretty much the same challenges here in Massachusetts. Among the number of families who are receiving the TSA program, the housing voucher assistance, Massachusetts was number two or number three in the country. Currently, there are about between 500 and 600 families receiving this benefit. And just like the councilwoman said, here it's families that don't have access to a kitchen in a hotel, families that have to figure out how to get their kids to school when they have no transportation. So it's pretty much the same. To me, the most heartbreaking thing that I saw was that in Holyoke, this is in Western Massachusetts, this is a city, there were families there that were arriving in large numbers. And, you know, I spoke to people who actually were going hungry because, again, that not having access to a kitchen in a hotel is something that, you know, we don't really think of, you know, being a big deal. But for these families, that means that they have to, you know, find ways to cook their own meals or buy their own meals, which obviously makes it more expensive and more challenging. So I heard from a lot of people that hunger was a very, you know, big concern because they were going days without eating. So for a lot of these families, yes, this benefit is supposed to be temporary. But when you have kids, and like the councilwoman said, many of these families have, you know, small kids, you have to, you know, sign them up for school. And so when you're thinking about leaving or transitioning out of housing, that becomes a large concern. Where are my kids going to go to school? They're in school here. I don't want to disrupt them anymore. So you want to find housing options nearby to minimize that disruption. So the challenges are pretty much the same, and it's pretty dire.
And Marcela, who is helping them with those challenges? I mean, the councilwoman is describing a situation where 6 months after the storm now, many of these families, you're describing them as well, living in conditions, yeah, that would be okay for a week or two in an emergency, eating packaged food or in some cases no food at all. Who is helping them transition to a regular life or figure out what a regular life can be in a completely new place in the mainland?
Community organizations are playing a big role, and if it weren't for them, I guarantee you, I mean, I don't know what would have been of these families. The state and cities and towns are also intervening, you know, the housing authorities of each city and town. I know that here in Boston, for example, there's a large number of these families already enrolled or signed up in waiting list for public housing because, again, like you can help them transition, but if there is no housing to transition to, it's a puzzle that nobody can really solve. I mean, housing, affordable housing is a challenge here in Massachusetts, period, let alone for just families who are fleeing a hurricane. So what I'm seeing now, what I've been hearing for these community organizations that are on the ground helping these families is that many people just get frustrated and, you know, hit a dead end and say, I'm just leaving. And either they go back to Puerto Rico, or they go to another state where they have another friend or another family member who can host them for a little while longer. So what you're going to see is, you know, this population of displaced families basically moving from place to place if there is no, you know, other program or more permanent slash long-term assistance because they're going to need it and they're still in need of it.
Councilwoman Bermudez, who in your community is helping these families move on from the Red Roof Inn to a more normal life?
The situation in Hartford, you know, as the capital city in Connecticut, is very dire in that while I've mentioned the number of families of the three participating hotels of the families that we know of, there's a host of other families, right, that are staying with people they might know from that, you know, that they have family or relatives with who are also Puerto Rican. In Hartford and specifically, we've received to date 1,820 individuals. And in our school system, we've seen an influx of enrollment of 500 new students in our public school system. Now, the people who've been really mobilizing and helping to engage these families and connect these families with resources, the group that has done the most immediate work has been the volunteers, and they've been the fastest moving group. But overall, it's piecemeal. We're piecemealing these services that these families need right now. And so really it's been very challenging in that it's so difficult to try to get all the resources in one-stop shop, right? And with very little to no support from the federal government, specifically I'm referencing FEMA.
Well, Marcella, let me end with you before we have to run here. Marcella, is anyone talking about a permanent solution here? TSA, FEMA, these agencies have warned of another deadline. Money for these hotels isn't going to be around forever. In Hartford, they're trying hard, but it sounds overwhelming with this piecemeal approach that the councilwoman is describing. What's the end game here?
There is talk already of other permanent solutions or more long-term solutions. There are other programs that FEMA, like the Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program, could deploy. And the governor of Puerto Rico has requested FEMA to deploy these other tools that they have. And specifically, I'm talking about a program that's called the Direct Lease Program. And FEMA, what it does is that it pays basically landlords, it pays directly the rent to landlords up to 8 months for eligible victims. And so this is a program that has already been requested, and FEMA has this program available only in Puerto Rico for Puerto Rican victims on the island. But the governor and other agencies have requested FEMA to make it available to people here in the mainland. You know, all these families whose TSA benefit will end eventually for some of them today, actually. For other people, we will end in May 14 to make this direct lease program available here. And again, it would mean 18 months more of housing. And it's true. I mean, this hurricane has a long, long, long tail, and it's going to be, these families are going to need more than another month or two.
Marcella Garcia, editorial writer with the Boston Globe, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Councilwoman Wildelise Bermudez of the Hartford City Council, thank you as well.
Thank you.
We reached out for a comment to FEMA's Region 1 office serving states across New England, including the Hartford area. We haven't yet heard back. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. A new study on race and wealth across America is raising a lot of new questions about how class and racism conspire against Black boys and Black men. The study was led by researchers at Stanford and Harvard and the Census Bureau, and it looked at 20 million American children and their parents over 16 years. It found that even at the very top of the income scale, Black boys who grow up rich are more than twice as likely to wind up poor than similar white boys when they're adults.
For a long time, scholars have argued that class has played a big role in upward mobility in America. And I think after reading this story, it really questions that. And to understand, well, class may play a role, but it seems to be that race also has some significance here.
That's Malo Andre Hudson, an associate professor at Columbia University and director of the Urban Community and Health Equality Lab, who says the study shows in hard numbers that racism and institutional roadblocks must be inhibiting Black men.
I think we have to start looking at what is it about American society that may be impacting Black males in a different way. What is the lived experience of Black males in America? So we should look at things like negative stereotypes of Black males, either being perceived as violent or someone to be feared, or in other cases, they might be perceived as being entertainers or athletes. As a professor myself and a Black male, I can tell you when I walk around my campus, oftentimes people ask me, am I an athlete? Am I a coach? Or they either fear me. And what that really says to me is that we either are here for entertainment or we're something to be feared, but there's not a lot of discussion or thoughts about us being doctors, architects, artists, scientists, and so forth.
One of the puzzling things that came from this study, Professor, is that the deviation in wealth doesn't seem to bear out for Black girls. If Black girls grow up rich with all of the other factors similar to white girls, they tend to be just as likely to stay wealthy as those similar white girls. It's not the case for Black boys. What does that say to you?
It tells me that there's something that is happening in America with Black boys and Black men. So we need to look at our institutions, whether it be educational institutions, the criminal justice system, their overall experience of being incorporated or being integrated into society in a way that is positive and helps with upward mobility. Obviously, this is a complex issue and needs to be looked at further. But I would say that there's certainly something going on because you don't see the same income gap, as you mentioned, among black girls and white girls. So I would say as a professor of urban planning, I think about the built environment and community structures and institutions. And what are the ways that these are serving all members of society or in some ways might be through structural racism or bias might be impacting black males?
You know, in a lot of ways, Professor Hudson, this massive study that's gotten so much attention didn't really seem to answer as many questions as it asked. You know, it really seemed to blow the door open to this demand for more research to find out why this pretty much undeniable disparity for black boys exists in America. So as a researcher yourself, let's talk about that door being blown open for more research. What do you need to know from the data? What do you need to know from the census and other studies to start to bear out how America can begin to solve this problem?
So I would say one of the things that we should start focusing on is the overall educational institution. So what type of education are black men getting? What's their human capital look like? What's their social capital look like? I would also say that this study debunks the cognitive ability argument that says, well, it's really these innate differences in cognitive ability that might be adding to this income gap. And in fact, that if that were the case, you would see a gap among black girls and white girls. And that is not the case. So in some ways, the study's done a great job of helping us look at other factors and in many ways debunking previous explanations. So I'd say as we move forward, it would be important to start looking at the importance of early childhood education, the role of mentoring, even the role of counseling and advising services for black boys. If you're an educator, I would say looking at school systems. In the case of Oakland Unified School District, they have an African-American male achievement program that is specifically focusing on the lived experience of young black boys within the school system. And I would say as a society, that's something we may think about is as we move forward, what policies and programs might we develop that specifically address some of these issues and are targeted towards black men and black boys?
Professor, we're two men talking here, and that's fine, but you might read this study, one might read this study and come away with the conclusion that this type of discrimination doesn't affect black girls, and that when black girls become black women, well, they have it pretty good, because if they grow up rich, they stay rich, and whatever this problem is, it's not affecting them. I take it that that conclusion would be erroneous, that discrimination doesn't play a role for them.
Absolutely, and I think when you're talking about the gender dynamic of women in society, and that's for all women, I would say that there's still a lot of work to be done in society, but certainly this study sheds great light because it's a longitudinal study, really looking at intergenerational upward mobility, and I think that that sheds a tremendous amount of light for researchers, for policymakers, for educators and so forth, and many others out in society that are trying to build institutions that create a more inclusive society.
Well, you know, Professor Hudson, we're going to let you go, but I just want to talk about that animated graphic that the New York Times ran along with its report on this study that really captured, I think, the imagination of a lot of readers. You just see this pipeline of little dots, white boys and black boys, kind of flowing down the pipeline as they grow up. And then the dots that represent black boys, they just slide to the bottom. When you saw that, what were people talking about when that cartoon came out?
Well, A, how sad it was, and B, unfortunately, how realistic it is being black in America. And so on one level, many people were not necessarily surprised, but certainly hurt about the data, because oftentimes, as I said, we've talked about the role of class. But when you start looking at children who are born to parents in the top 1%, basically millionaires, and in that case, for black families as well, and they still have a likely chance of the downward mobility in ending in the bottom quintile. So I think that that raises questions among my friends and colleagues saying, what is it about American society? What is it about our institutions? What is it about racism? What is it about the overall lived experience, whether you be black, male or female, but certainly a black male, that is leading to these types of income gaps that we see? And what as a society are we going to do about it? So thinking about the labor market, thinking about institutions, thinking about the ways that we create support systems and mentoring systems and so forth that are necessary to be successful.
Dr. Malo, Andre Hudson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Malo Andre Hudson is associate professor at Columbia University and director of the Urban Community and Health Equality Lab. And we wanted to know, how does your economic situation compare to your parents?
This is Aisha calling from Dallas. It's hard to answer the socioeconomic question because I'm an immigrant, and in a way, my socioeconomic status is better because I have more opportunities potentially available to me. But in another sense, it's not so much better because I do have to start from scratch without family support or connections, frankly, that others might have.
Hi, this is Bruce Bennett from Plano, Texas. Only one of my parents went to high school. I worked my way through college, joined ROTC, and after grad school, managed a team of people at age 23. My advantage over my parents was education and experience at an early age.
Hi, this is Beth from White Plains, New York. My socioeconomic status is about 10 times what my parents was. I was first generation college educated, married a professional, had a career before and after kids, and have a similar high achieving peer group. It's said that your income is the average of the six people you spend the most time with. For me, that's a white collar professional group, whereas for my parents, it was proudly blue collar.
Hi, my name is Eric. I live in Philadelphia. I am in a somewhat lower class position than my father was at the high point of his career when he was a college professor, about the same level, however, that my mother was when she died, when she was just renting and retired. And not being at a higher level now, I mostly attribute to personal circumstances that affected my psychological well-being and affected my motivation.
James, Dover, Ohio. I'd say much higher. My parents were both school teachers. Less education and more life experience that has enabled me to make more than most with 4 years degree, less the college debt. My parents converted from Catholic to Amish when I was 12. I left at 21, but took the work ethic that I learned with me.
My name is Pamela. I'm calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We are better off by far than our parents. They were the first generation here and worked the family business where we all learned how to work and work hard. The family business is now 107 years old and well into the third generation.
A huge discussion going on here on the show and online on our Facebook page and on Twitter as well. This is The Takeaway. Let's talk gadgets for just a minute. It's happened to you before. Your iPhone screen shatters. Your brand new blender gets jammed. Or maybe even your new tractor breaks down. Now, if any of these things happen to you, and I know one of them has, if you're feeling industrious or maybe you just can't afford a replacement, you might try to fix it yourself, only to find out that the manufacturer has made these things almost impossible to DIY. Well, lawmakers in California and in other states want to fix that. Jason Kebler is editor-in-chief of Motherboard. He's here to explain the proposed right to repair bill.
So a right to repair law would make it easier for you to fix your electronics. Right now, it's very hard to get an iPhone screen, for example, or an iPhone battery, or even like a John Deere tractor part. You have to go through the manufacturers or their dealers. So these laws would require companies to sell repair parts, sell replacement tools, as well as put online guides to repairing your devices.
So talk a little bit, Jason, about the situation that's begging to be fixed by this proposed law, according to its sponsors. Let's say my iPhone battery goes bad. Actually, my iPhone battery did go bad. I've been going through this like millions of other Americans. What am I likely to confront if I say, no, I want to find that screwdriver. I want to fix this.
Right. So it's actually not that hard to replace the battery in iPhone if you have the right tools. You know, you need like a suction cup to pull the screen off. You need the screwdriver. You need to pull the battery out. There's some like gross glue under there. And then you pop a new one in, you put the screen back on, and you're fine. If you have tried to get your iPhone battery replaced in the last few months, as so many people have, you may have been forced to wait, you know, a couple weeks to go to an Apple store. There are many people who live hundreds of miles from an Apple store. Like if you live in a rural area, you know, some states only have one or two Apple stores in the entire state. So it is tough to get your phone fixed under those circumstances. What these laws hope to do is enable independent companies to fix your things. So you'd be able to go to the corner store down the street. They could fix your phone in 5 or 10 minutes, and you'd be on your way.
So Apple, and they're not alone, lots of other companies, Samsung, Microsoft, other companies too, have been fighting pretty hard against this right to repair law. What are they saying? Why should they be able to have exclusive domain over repairing these devices that we pay so much for?
Right. So they say that it is a safety and security issue. They actually don't say much. They generally work through trade organizations to make their public statements. But behind closed doors, what we've seen is Apple will tell lawmakers that, this will invite hackers to their states. And so, they have made a very good business repairing iPhones. And if you look at it from their perspective, it is kind of a pain. If a law like this passed, they would be forced to, sell these replacement parts. They would probably be forced to deal with people who, can't fix their things. But the fact remains that there are a lot of professionals and DIY type people out there who are capable of fixing their own things.
All right. Well, Jason, look, I get the explanation from the tech companies. I don't want to be down on them too much. But this really does, when you hear it, this does sound like some pretty rich companies that just want to keep utter control over these devices and maybe influence us to just buy a new one when something goes wrong instead of trying to make a fix.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at our electronics, they are disposable at this point. I mean, how long does anyone keep a phone? There's a lot of talk about planned obsolescence. I don't go that conspiratorial. But the fact remains that, if you're not buying a new phone from Apple, like, you're not giving them any money. So they have fought very hard against this legislation in many states. And the people who are pushing this legislation say that if it does pass in any state, it would effectively become sort of a national law. So the stakes are high here. The reason for that is because if Apple is required to sell replacement parts in California, someone could simply sell the replacement parts from California to New York or California to Wyoming. If they have to put this information online, it would immediately get out. And so any one state passing this law would benefit everyone.
Jason Kebler, editor-in-chief of Motherboard. Jason, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. For the last few weeks, the New York Times has been busy rolling out a new project. It's called Overlooked, where dozens of women are now getting long overdue obituaries in the New York Times. Well, we've been right there along with our friends at the Times, talking to authors of these new obituaries and learning about the women who made a mark on history. You can hear all about the women they've profiled so far, plus your nominations for Overlooked Women from History. It's all on our website at thetakeaway.org/overlooked. Well, this week, novelist Nella Larsen. Larsen was an acclaimed writer in the Harlem Renaissance. We're talking New York in the 1920s. She got some recognition at the time, but spent decades in relative obscurity once her writing career slowed down.
Most everyone who was mentioned during that time or who came to sort of the forefront, those were the men.
That's Dr. Jacqueline McClendon, professor emerita of English and Africana Studies at the College of William & Mary in Virginia.
Some of the black women who were writing during that period of time, they were characterized as one older critic said, as part of the rear guard. And Nella Larsen was one of those people, but she is one of the best writers that came of age during that period.
Nella Larsen wrote two novels, Quicksand and Passing, and they're both considered important works dealing with race and gender. They were pretty well received at the time, but when Larsen died in 1964, she never got an obituary in the New York Times. Well, now, nearly 55 years later, she has, and Bonnie Wertheim, who's an editor of the Style section at the New York Times, wrote that obituary. I asked Bonnie to tell us about the life and the work of Nella Larsen.
She was born in Chicago. Her mom was from Denmark and her dad was from the Danish West Indies. So Nella was a mixed race woman at a time when it was seen as kind of suspect for a white woman to be, holding the hand of an apparently black child. And she grew up in, a working class neighborhood of immigrants in Chicago and attended schools with mostly white European immigrant children. She was always incredibly intellectually curious, but I don't think the idea of being a writer crossed her mind until
far later in her life.
So Nella Larsen would have been, I guess, about 28 or 30, around this time that the Harlem Renaissance, as it's known now, kicked off in the early 20s in
yes.
New York. How did she fit in?
At the time, she had recently acquired a degree in library science from the New York Public Library and was working at the 135th Street branch there. She was also pretty recently married to an incredibly prominent black physicist named Elmer Imes, who was in with the Langston Hughes's and the Du Boises of 1920s Harlem. And I don't think that Nella could have found her way into that world of artists and intellectuals if she wasn't riding on the social capital of her husband. That's not to say that she wasn't deserving of it. I just don't know that she would have been recognized or recognized herself as a writer.
Well, Nella Larsen was mixed race, as mm-hmm. you mentioned, a white mother and a black father, at a time when there was a great deal of social stigma mm-hmm. around mixed race children. How did that inform her writing and what she wrote about, what she chose to write
yeah.
about?
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, Nella Larsen's characters resemble her protagonists especially. In the two novels, the leading characters are women who are mixed race and are living middle-class urban lives. And I think in a lot of ways, Nella wrote about what she had experienced and people's relationships to arts and academia.
So Nella Larsen was reviewed during her life. She was well-reviewed, in fact, in more than one publication and some pretty important ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question becomes why she never got an obituary in the New York Times when she died. They were certainly aware of who she was.
They were certainly aware of who she was. But the thing about Nella is that she stopped writing. And I think that is the biggest reason why she is not the most well-known author from the Harlem Renaissance today. So after she published her second novel, Passing, she started one more novel. She had received a Guggenheim Fellowship and was the first black woman to receive one of those prestigious arts grants. And she used that money to spend some time in Europe working on her next novel. When she sent it out to her publisher, they were lukewarm at best and expressed no great interest in ever publishing the book. And at the same time that she is abroad, she is aware that her husband, Elmer Imes, is having an affair with a woman at the university where he's teaching. And she knows that, A, she doesn't want to be a professor's wife. She doesn't want to be a person on campus who's just an accessory to her husband. And she knows that she doesn't want to be publicly shamed, really, in this community where everyone knows that her husband is involved with another woman. So when she returns to the U.S., she and Elmer end up deciding that they're going to divorce. She receives alimony from him for the rest of his life, but he dies decades before she does. And once she no longer is financially supported by him, she ends up breaking all of her ties with the Harlem community, returns to nursing, and works in hospitals in Manhattan for her remaining years until she's about 70. She completely divorced herself from all of the writers who had become her peers and friends and never communicates with them again.
Well, Bonnie, the Overlooked Project is broad at the New York Times, and there are lots and lots of options for women who were overlooked in the obituary pages of the paper. What made you choose Nella Larsen? Why this author?
I had read her books when I was in college, and they always stood out to me because they talk about race and class and gender in such nuanced ways. And because of the way a lot of American literature is constructed and taught, I had not previously been exposed to the storyline of a black woman who is living a well-to-do life and is forced to conform to, you know, politics of respectability and what that does to her character. You watch the women in Nella Larsen's books unravel because a lot of what's going on in their minds is at odds with how people want them to act and be seen in the world. So I think of her as someone who constantly questioned, to what extent should other people's expectations determine who we are, and how far outside of those lines can we go without being ostracized from a community and still feel true to ourselves.
Bonnie Wertheim is an editor in the Style section of the New York Times who wrote an obituary for author Nella Larsen, overlooked by the New York Times during her life. Nella Larsen died in 1964. Bonnie Wertheim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd. This was great.
We reached out to some authors who've appeared on The Takeaway, asking them about Nella Larsen and her work. Tayari Jones, who's the author of the new book, An American Marriage, wrote to us on Twitter, "I taught Passing a couple of semesters ago. I read it as a novel about the pleasures in blackness. It really holds up all these years later. It's not all, geez Louise, black people who look white." And WNYC's Rebecca Carroll tweeted, "In college, Passing was pivotal, literary, nuanced, and brave, and also a little terrifying." This is The Takeaway. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know, in the Trump era, some comedians say the jokes write themselves, right? And if you say they want to talk about anything but the president when they're on stage. Stand-up Aparna Nancherla, though, says she's just ready.
Yeah, I am someone who has a lot of anxiety, and it is weird that anxiety is finally on message. Like, if you're an anxious person, it's kind of like, well, you know, this is what we trained for. Like, this is our Olympics. It's like all those nights awake, like it's showtime, you know? All the scenarios at once.
That's part of Aparna Nancherla's newest half-hour special premiering today as part of the stand-up series from Netflix. Nancherla doesn't talk much about politics in the new Netflix special, but she has carved out a rising career in the comedy world, writing for Late Night with Seth Meyers and voicing a key character in the fourth season of the Netflix animated series BoJack Horseman.
My name is Hollyhock Mannheim Mannheim Guerrero Robinson Zilberschlag Sungfonzarelli McQuack.
Wait. What's your first name?
Hollyhock.
Wait, what's your last name?
I know, it's confusing. I have eight dads.
But even as her work brings her in front of bigger and bigger audiences, Nancherla says she's...
introvert, at times violently quiet, honest.
I sat down with Aparna Nancherla recently, and she explained why, for comedy, she considers it a strength.
I would say a fair number of comedians are introverts in that we sort of absorb the world pretty over-analytically with like just an overactive brain. And then the most comfortable way to retranslate those thoughts into a, you know, public way is like in front of a bunch of strangers, which I think could be something further delved into in therapy. But but yeah, I think there's some catharsis to it. I think I've always wanted to perform, but not, you know, not felt like necessarily like I was a theater person or anything. So sort of when I happened on stand-up, I was like, oh, this works. It's essentially just like reading diary entries out loud.
Easier to do it in front of like 300 faceless people who you don't know rather than, you know, one-on-one or...
Oh, yeah. Like, I still think, like, a theater is less stressful to me than, like, a coffee shop with, like, 10 people where you can see all their faces.
So you have a new stand-up special. You've done some writing as well.
Yeah.
For TV. You worked on some of the late-night shows with Seth Meyers, a couple of other ones.
Yeah. The first writing job I had was actually what brought me to New York, which was totally biased with W. Kamau Bell, which was a show that ran for two seasons on FX. He was a comic who was out of the Bay Area and sort of very left-leaning and socially progressive. And so we would talk about a lot of social justice issues. And I think that was the first time I think I got a little bit more politically active and aware as a whole.
What was the writer's room like for you? The rap on places like that is that they're overwhelmingly white and male. I don't know if that's still the case or what it was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I lucked out in that first job with Totally Biased because it was kind of a more liberal bent and trying to do something different. The writer's room was probably on the more diverse end of things. Like, I would say the Caucasian persuasion was the minority in the room. And there were, I think we were up to three women, maybe two women the first season. But I think it was maybe the abnormal end of things in terms of being a lot more progressive and diverse and having a lot of different experiences represented in the room. So I think that kind of set a foundation for me of like, oh, this can also be normal. You just have to sometimes make that effort. But yeah, I think it's interesting. The late night model, I think some people would argue, is now getting a little outdated. And it's like, you know, it's still kind of stuck in a very specific formula that hasn't been broken for many years. And some people think that like talk shows should move in different directions. But I think I learned overall from working in those environments that maybe it's not quite the perfect environment for me, just that it is a grind of like you're making a different show every day and that you kind of have to reset. But I think for me, I was like, offices make me restless anyway, maybe from PTSD to temping or something. So I think I am better suited to be like, I'll just, you know, wander the city and tweet twice.
Now, you talk about Twitter in your Netflix special, in your Netflix set. And Twitter has this just fascinating role for comics now, right? There's these, it seems like, hundreds of great Twitter comedians who've risen up out of nowhere because of this format. In that way, it seems like it's been a boon for comedy, but I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the internet has sort of changed the game in terms of who are the gatekeepers now for comedy and how people find an audience or are first seen. So in that sense, I think it's at least provided accessibility that wasn't there before for a lot of people.
But look, Twitter has done great things for comedy. It also allows your audience and your trolls and your hecklers to have direct access to you. You talk about this as well and what that experience is like.
You know, as a comedian, you get a lot of feedback online. Sometimes people are nice, but other times they're like, instead of doing comedy, I wish you were made of bees, you know, or whatever it is. This is one of the meanest comments I've gotten. Jesus Christ, you're perhaps the ugliest human on the planet. But then again, I haven't left the planet. Again, I enjoy this one because there's an introspective shift.
The nice thing about social media is like you might get more hecklers, quote unquote, as trolls are online, but you can just mute or block them, which is so much easier than a show where you can't just be like, silence.
Do you feel the need, though, to respond to your trolls online? One of the gauntlets of comedy on stage, right? And tell me if this is wrong, is totally owning a heckler.
Sure.
Right? You try to own a troll or you just ignore them?
I think if, you know, if they catch me at an emotionally vulnerable moment, I might respond and then immediately mute so I can't further engage with them, which is not that fair because it is essentially like doing a snappy comeback and then just leaving the room. But I think it is like how much time and energy do you want to put into addressing people who are probably at the most just looking for a reaction?
Well, also culling material because it's provided you with some good material for
your
act, too.
I should give them more credit.
That's part of the thing about trolling is that people expect to insult you or demean you and then sort of scurry off into the dark.
Sure.
You make them part of the act.
Well, I also think I'm always fascinated with trolls because I myself have a very loud inner critic. I'm sort of fascinated with the idea of criticism as a whole and the way we judge ourselves and how that leads us to judge others. And so essentially trolling to me feels like a lot of people are probably unhappy with their own place in life or they're not getting enough satisfaction that they have to sort of take it out on other people. So I think there is something at the heart of it that as a undergrad psych major, I find interesting.
Your inner critic, though, if it were quieter or nicer, would you be as funny?
I always go back and forth on this argument where it's like the more tortured you are, the better you are at art, because I do think as someone who's dealt with mental health over pretty much most of my life and went on antidepressants, and that actually was the first thing that helped me to get the courage to do stand up. Like, I think I would argue that being able to manage your mental health is, to me, affords me the ability to do comedy more than having that brain in the first place.
Aparna Nancherla stars in the stand-up series on Netflix with a 30-minute set, heading out on the road soon with her comedy all across America, so you can catch her there. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You You know, I did ask Aparna what it was like playing an angst-ridden teenage horse on BoJack Horseman. Here's what she said.
I feel like I probably have a part of my teenage self that's still very much alive, so it was kind of easy to just tap back into that.
Well, that's the teenage part of it. Doesn't say a whole lot about the horse part. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.